I am practicing with my children what it means to be free inside of our household. So when they go out in the world, they know what it means to have their freedom impinged upon. And so they know what it means and what it looks like to stand up for themselves in the face of that.
Welcome to the Anti-Authoritarian Podcast, the podcast about how we win against authoritarianism and become the founders of a free country. This season, our conversations run along three streams. The first stream is arts and culture. We feature arts and culture because culture flows upstream of politics, prefiguring the possible and showing people what freedom feels like. The second stream is elections. Holding the line around free and fair elections is critical to protecting our freedoms. And the third is the world beyond our borders. We focus there because authoritarianism is a global project and the resistance has to be too. What connects all three is a conviction that we can win if we act strategically, build across our differences, and use the tools of nonviolent civil resistance that have turned back authoritarian movements before. Let's get into it. Lately, I've been thinking a lot about a feature of authoritarian targeting that doesn't get enough attention. It almost always begins with women. Not because women are the weakest target, but because controlling women's bodies, agency, and political power is foundational to the authoritarian project. I wrote about this in the Anti-Authoritarian Playbook, the idea that self-government begins with the self, the body you actually live in. A woman with full authority over her own body and her own choices is not a pendant in a fixed hierarchy. An authoritarian order depends on hierarchy, from the household up. That's why the misogyny driving far-right power building isn't incidental. It's structural. It's a feature. But here's what that analysis also tells us. Women have always been at the center of freedom movements because they understand what's at stake. And the women who combine healing and organizing while understanding that you can't sustain a movement without sustaining the people in it are some of the most strategically sophisticated people in the fight. My guest today is Tamika Middleton, Chief Strategy Officer of the Women's March and co-founder of Kindred Southern Healing Collective. This is a conversation about women, power, mass action, healing justice, and what it actually takes to hold the line. Tamika, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, funny we find ourselves in these spaces, isn't it? So I have a question for you that I ask of just about everyone nowadays. What does freedom mean to you? And what does it mean to you to live in a free country?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's such a great question because I think it is one of those things that as an organizer, I think we talk about fighting for freedom, fighting for liberation, and we don't really exercise a kind of imagination that will like point us in that direction. And so I think, you know, for me, what it means to live in a free country is to have the kind of space and autonomy to make choices for my life, for my children's lives, for my family's lives, choices inside of our communities that allow us to thrive and allow us to be authentically who we are. Choices that support our collective well-being as well as our individual well-being. So that we're not sort of sacrificing ourselves for the whole, but we are sort of thinking about and building towards a world in which we can thrive individually and collectively. And so I think about, you know, how we practice democracy, how we practice autonomy, self-determination inside of our communities as like the way in which we move to freedom. I always talk about, you know, my children are unschooled. And so, which is like, you know, a form of homeschooling, sort of self-directed. And I've always talked about it as part of my liberation practice, that I am practicing with my children what it means to be free inside of our household. So when they go out in the world, they know what it means to have their freedom impinged upon. And so they know what it means and what it looks like to stand up for themselves in the face of that.
Amazing. So, you know, that term free country, though, that's something I grew up with, right? Mm-hmm. So somebody tries to squash you, say, but it's free country, yeah. Right? You can't stop me from doing what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So where does that fit in your, you know, ideas about freedom?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so interesting because I am thinking about how we design a country that lives into sort of the ideals of many, many different communities, right? And so I think, you know, there's this picture, a sort of way in which we talk about a free country that's really just about like being able to do whatever we individually want to do. Like, I can do whatever I want. It's a free country. and I think that feels different to me than a freedom in which we can self-determine, but we're also cognizant of and bought into the concept of our the well-being of our folks too, right? Not just like what it is, whatever it is I want to do, but how am I aware of how the thing I want to do may cause harm to my to the people around me? How am I aware of like the fact that I am connected to the people around me? And so my freedom is tied up in their freedom as well. And so I think I would love for us to move into a place that is not this sort of individualistic, I can do it, whatever it is that I want to do. It's a free country, but that is more of like, we are all a part of the country together, right? Like we are all in this thing together. And so I want to live into that kind of ideal of freedom. And I know, you know, we were talking about this last year, a Women's March did this Free America rally. We had, and we've been sort of moving the sort of Free America as a sort of concept. And one of the things that, you know, the conversation I had last year for the fourth was like, for me, as a Black woman, as a Gullah Geechee woman, I think I have a very particular set of lineage around how we fight for what it, for, you know, a quote unquote free country. I come from a community. I come from a lineage. My third great grandfather fought in the Civil War and was in that, you know, First South Carolina regiment alongside Harriet Tubman. And so I live inside of a lineage of folks who have fought for freedom inside of the confines of this country and have also recognized the ways in which the freedom that this country has promised has not been realized. And is not the same vision of freedom that we held. And so I think I am interested in expanding what it means to be a free country into one that is more collective and less individual.
Well, we need to clone you. Let's talk about the roles of women in pro-democracy movements. Mm-hmm. So right now we're facing a extremely well-organized global authoritarian movement that wants to not only take away freedom from us, but also end our means to organize for change by taking away the right to protest, the right to free expression. Can you talk about the misogyny at the core of the authoritarian building and organizing strategy? And the impacts women are experiencing under authoritarian consolidation?
Absolutely. I think it's so interesting if we look at, you know, other authoritarian regimes and we can go back to Italy, we can go back to, you know, Nazi Germany and see the ways in which gender, the defining the segmentation of folks by gender has been such a crucial part of building the authoritarian project. And in particular, being very specific about gender roles and really sort of, I want to say old school is what's coming to my mind about, you know, those definitions of gender roles and not allowing folks to sort of stray inside or outside of that in any particular way. And so we see that happening right now. And in particular, I think it's interesting the way that social media plays into the defining of that and the shaping of that in this era, because we see in the social media landscape, we see sort of the tradwife movement that is this push to younger women to say, hey, you know, this is what it means to be a traditional wife. This, look how glamorous it is. Look how easy my life is. And then there's like another push that is around princess treatment. And when we really look at it, like, hey, I spent, you know, a chunk of my life as a stay-at-home mom. And I think part of being a feminist is allowing folks to self-determine for themselves what their lives look like. And also, I am very clear that work inside the home is work. and that child rearing is work. And that work should be valued and is not, and does not define you, that we all should be able to choose the kind of labor that we want to partake in and engage in inside of our lives. And so there's this sort that, that sort of trad wife push trend. There is another trend that is around princess treatment. That's like, hey, we want to live a soft life. And so I am, I don't engage with anyone. There was one video where this woman went out on a date and her husband opened the doors and she literally didn't talk to a single person the entire night. He ordered for her. He spoke for her. Anytime there was someone engaging, she did not engage. And I'm like, that feels less like softness and more like control. And so how do we, and not just control, but actually creating a dynamic wherein women are further removed from people outside of the household. How do you make interventions around violence if I'm not allowed to engage with the people outside, you know, outside of my marriage? And so there is this push. I also have seen in some of the talks that they're having with young women, college age women, around having as many children as you can, even if you can't afford it, which I think the irony of it all, especially as a Black woman, is interesting, because of course the messaging has been, you know, historically around those, you know, welfare moms who are having more children than they can afford. And the messaging is really flipped. And so I think that is encouraging women to not go to college, not go to get into the workforce, and really sort of pushing that, those sort of narratives. But then also we see this attempt to at control inside of families in terms of this narrative around changing the ability or changing the rules around divorce, right? And making it harder for women to leave marriages, to leave situations that are difficult. And I think so much of this is how authoritarians really reshape society and reorder society in order to create and really built into this hierarchy, but saying, hey, you have a very specific role in the national project, and your role is to be at home and to allow your men to go out into the workforce and for you to raise the children to then also fill into those same specific roles. And there's also really clear ways in which that all of these narratives also are tied into the treatment of queer and gender nonconforming and trans folks as well, right? Mm-hmm. This very narrow defining of gender is and has been historically a part of how authoritarians keep people in line.
So, you know, I often talk to people about women-centered organizing and I advocate for it. And people react to that like it's some kind of a concession to identity politics. Whereas what I think is that it's a strategic recognition of where civil resistance power actually lives. Mm-hmm. And I know you know that. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think I've learned some of that from you. So my question is, you know, if that's the case, what about the role of women in today's movement, you know, and why do women need to be central to what we're doing?
I mean, I think, you know, when we think about the concept of identity politics, I think what the Combahee River Collective offered us is an opportunity to really ground in context and in the landscape that we're fighting inside of. What are all of the things that we're bringing to the table? What are all the experiences that actually need to shape the way we think about how we fight and what we are fighting for and what we are fighting against? And I think there's very particular ways that women are experiencing things that have to shape what we understand as the landscape that we're fighting in and who the opposition is. And so if we think about, in particular, reproductive justice, reproductive rights, right? We've been in this long battle around abortion access. And those are the same people. If we are to trace the, you know, who the opposition is, who are the people funding, who are the, you know, the formations that have been leading the charge there, we find the same folks who are at the forefront of pushing these authoritarian politics and this authoritarian movement and across the globe, honestly. And so if we were to take a moment to actually think about the things that are important to women, the ways in which women are impacted, then we can also identify our opposition and identify our landscape really clearly. And I think too, you know, Patricia Hill Collins wrote in Black Feminist Thought, she talks about Black feminist epistemologies. And there are particular ways of knowing that you embody just from being in the experience of being a Black woman. And I think that's true about women broadly, that there are particular ways of knowing that come from living and experiencing the world as a woman, that come from living and experiencing the world as a mother, come from living and experiencing the world as a wife. There are very particular things we understand about what is happening. And there are particular things that matter to us that, if we put them at the center, shift the landscape. And when we talk about Patricia Hill Collins in particular, she talks about, you know, the way in which if we rise the tide for Black women, then we rise the tide for everyone. So if we can rise the tide for women, if we can address the things that are at the core of women's experiences, the ways in which women are experiencing oppression, then we actually get to the core of what's happening to everybody else. Right? Or to so many other folks. So if we think about the abortion access fight, right? There was a particular conversation I had with a Georgia-based organizer who was talking about the abortion fight and talking about it in relation to civic engagement. And we're saying that there are ways in which the abortion fight, if we center abortion, we can actually talk to other people in very specific ways. If we talk about abortion, we can talk about the court system with men. We can talk about, like, there are all these other things that actually rise to the surface if we talk about things that matter to women that we might not have actually paid attention to. And so I think that feels really important. But there's also ways in which women organize that feels important as well. There are ways in which women do the work of bringing people together that feels important as well. When I organize in spaces with other women and that are women-centered and women-led, I find that I know there's gonna be food at the meeting. I know we're gonna make sure people are fed. That's important, right? That's important to meet people's basic needs. I know that there's gonna be childcare at that meeting, because if I want, you know, a woman who works 9 to 5 and who is directly impacted by what's happening to show up at my meeting, I need to make sure that she has a space for her kids to show up as well. So the particular ways that we organize that make space for more people and that make space for us to actually build a mass movement.
Well, you listed some barriers, right, kind of implicitly to women participating at the center. What else is out there that's standing in the way that we need to take care of?
Misogyny inside of our movement. It feels like really number one is that, you know, we live in the world. The misogyny is in the air. It's in the air we breathe. It's in the atmosphere that we were all raised in. And so none of us are immune from it. And so we have to be constantly fighting against it, even inside of the movement. We have been in places. I mean, I am at a women-centered organization with women leadership and women of color leadership in particular. And there have definitely been, you know, times where we have been in spaces and we're like, oh, no one's hearing us. But when we send our male colleague into that space, then the message lands. And so that the misogyny that exists inside of our movement, we have to be doing battle against. We just have to do it. Whether or not you decide that, you know, you're going to be a women-led or women-centered organization, we still have to be fighting the misogyny if we plan to build a free country, right? If we plan to fight authoritarianism, we just have to be doing it. And so I think that is one of the key barriers that I find, is being able to actually be in space and be heard, but also the misogyny that lends itself to the issues that are important to women, to gender justice issues, being seen as side issues, being seen as not fundamental. There was, you know, so much back and forth right around this last presidential election around, you know, what was going to be the core issue that we're going to take up. Was it going to be democracy or was it going to be abortion access? We're like, these are not separate issues. These are not distinct in one. Abortion access is not a side issue. Reproductive rights and reproductive justice is not a side issue to democracy. And so we have to not face these things as if the things that matter to women, the things that are gendered, are something over here, because gender justice matters for men too. Patriarchy impacts us all. And so we have to be fighting against that kind of misogyny that is inherent inside of our movements. I think, of course, yeah, like I said, you know, of course, there is access to childcare. I was talking to one of our organizers who's been leading and doing a ton of work around data centers and data center resistance work in Texas in particular. And she noted, she said, what I realized is that so many of the people who are in this fight with me are moms. And I don't think that's a thing that people are noticing or are paying attention to, because, you know, they are paying attention to the ways in which these data centers will impact their children and impact, you know, impact their children's future. And so, but what she also noticed was that they feel apprehensive about stepping in because they don't feel prepared. They don't feel like they have the training. They don't feel like they have the skill set. And so what are we offering in terms of leadership development for people on the ground that is accessible, that does not require you to have gone to grad school and got a master's degree in this thing, but that makes space for everyday people, everyday women to come into the movement?
Well, thanks for that. I honestly do really appreciate it. I appreciate the work of the Women's March greatly. It's a source of constant inspiration for me. So, you know, that was very useful analysis. I want to, though, tap your expertise and talk a little bit about strategic nonviolent action and decentralized movements. Mm-hmm. So, you know, over the last several months, the Women's March has organized and participated in several strategic nonviolent actions. Can you talk about which movements have inspired the creativity we've seen across your base?
Yeah, I mean, oh my gosh. I would say we had been, one of the things that we really have been talking about as a team a lot is Serbia and other European movements, and in particular the use of humor and ridicule as a key part of how we can do strategic nonviolence. How do we bring that sort of humor and ridicule into to sort of counter this strongman authoritarian narrative and propaganda? And so we definitely have been looking to those movements. We've been talking a lot, you know, for me, I'm always looking at movements on the African continent, looking at Kenya, looking at, and of course, you know, for myself and for some of my, a number of my colleagues, we are like students of the civil rights movement. So of course we're looking at, you know, at what we saw in the civil rights movement. We're students of the Combahee River Collective in particular, and other sort of feminist traditions here. We've been looking at, of course, Latin America and what we've seen the Latin American feminists do. So we've been really leaning on those traditions and trying to be really intentional about connecting to those movements as well, so that we can be constantly in conversation and in learning. We have been looking at the My Body, My Voice movement, a campaign that's been happening across the European Union, which is the sort of first multi-country policy around abortion access that just sort of moved through a European Parliament earlier this year in March, I think. And so there's so many movements that we've sort of really been paying attention to, and paying attention to Brazil. I mean, really learning from comrades and colleagues in Brazil. So many places that we've really been paying attention to in terms of strategic nonviolence. And I think, you know, we've spent a lot of time in Mexico talking to and learning from Mexican feminists and looking at the ways in which sort of the fight around matricide has shaped the feminist movement and how they've connected that and grown that to talk about abortion access. There's so many places for us to lean into and learn from, both historically and contemporarily. And we've been trying to like be in all the rooms and all the spaces with all the people to soak up all the things, because, you know, I was in a conversation with some folks talking about doing work in Brazil, and they were talking about how, you know, authoritarians move globally. Like, they have the intention to connect to each other and to build together globally. And in order to fight authoritarianism, we have to be doing the same thing. And so that's sort of, you know, a lot of what we've been trying to do is say, what are y'all seeing in Brazil? What are you seeing, you know, in Canada? We've been talking to folks in Canada. We've just been really doing the work of trying to connect to feminists in as many places as possible. So we've been inside of, you know, the sort of feminist peace frameworks that people have been building here and abroad, and just really sort of soaking up everything.
Well, when you talk about learning, I know you've been doing a lot of experimentation. So what have you been learning from that process?
We've been learning that people are ready for more, is one of the things that feels really, there's an appetite for people to do more. And that more looks a lot of different ways. So people really bit on walkouts. When we were doing walkouts in January. Now, of course, there's a lot of fear and a lot of learning that we have to be in. And that was one of the things that we noticed. But for the folks who were already taking action in marches, it wasn't a stretch for them to then say, okay, now we got to step it up and walkouts feel important, right? And so I think that's one of the things that we're learning, but we also are learning that we have to be in the work of developing people's leadership. So we can't just say, hey, we call for walkouts, go walk out. We have to actually prepare folks. We have to actually be training folks and giving them information and materials. And that part is really important because, again, you know, people are like, okay, I am a NICU nurse. What should I do? How can I be in solidarity? I'm a teacher. What should I do? How can I be in solidarity? How can I work this with my union? You know, like there's so many questions, and we've been able to cultivate all these questions and share them with, you know, with our peers, share them with the folks doing May Day, share them with, you know, with all of our folks. And so we've seen another thing that we've sort of seen is this trajectory in the research. We partnered with Dana Fisher to do some research of our folks who participated in the walkouts in January. And she's also been doing that, so some research with the folks who have participated in the No Kings actions. And we've seen this trajectory that, like, actually, you know, that first Women's March kickstarted a thing. And those folks continue to engage and continue to take action in lots of different ways. And so some of that is electoral, but a lot of that is that they keep coming out to marches. They participate in walkouts. They want to learn. They want to train. They want to build. Another thing that we're learning in terms of people wanting to do more is that people actually want to build the skill to do things locally. We've been offering tons of trainings. And one of the things that, one of the ones that people really sort of glommed onto and really wanted to be inside of is mutual aid. There's so much mutual aid and so many mutual aid efforts growing. And so giving people the tools and letting them go has been such a beautiful process to witness, and actually also offering people a space to then, even though they're building on their own, in their own communities, in their own networks, offering them a space for them to come together with other folks who are doing similar work and to share peer-to-peer and to learn peer-to-peer about, you know, what are we missing? What did y'all do that worked that we can try? Here's what we did that didn't work. And so offering them those spaces, be it, you know, in the comments on social media, or in the comments on the trainings, or in the app that we set up, has been really, really fruitful, because people not only want to take action, people are in it because they want to take action, but they also really want connection. People don't want to feel isolated. And people felt very isolated. So many of our folks told us after the election, after the presidential, that they felt isolated and that they were coming out to actions because they wanted to feel like they weren't alone. And so that's another piece of this, is that we still do need those mass actions, those mass mobilizations. And I know they get a ton of critique, but they are a way for people who have never been politicized before to find community, to find other folks who are questioning what they're seeing. And so some people might be at a place where the mass mobilization is not the thing for them and they want to escalate. And that's great. And that's important. But we actually, what we're learning more than anything is that we need all the tools in our toolbox, and we need to be preparing people and engaging people to use all the tools in our toolbox, all the tactics towards what our collective vision.
Well, that's really helpful. You know, I, throughout my many years of organizing, you know, usually lean into rage, but I've learned that there's a kind of loneliness epidemic in the U.S. Yes. And tapping into that, creating a sense of belonging for people, a community they can turn to that makes meaning of their lives, might be the better way to go, right?
So, and we find that even with our folks in like rural communities and small towns especially, will say, you know, I didn't even know there were other feminists until somebody organized the march and I showed up, and now we have a book club and we meet, you know, regularly, and we, you know, we're learning together about what feminism is. And I didn't know, because I live in this, you know, in rural Michigan, that there were other people who thought like me, who felt like me. And so that is really important if we're going to build at the scale that we want to build the kind of mass movement that is required to defeat authoritarianism. We have to lean into connection and into hope just as much as we lean into rage.
Yeah. Well, I, like you, am seeing the enthusiasm and feeling it, right? Mm-hmm. And I see the capacity to act growing, you know, like by leaps and bounds, hundreds of trainers training thousands of people in civil resistance tactics, right? Mm-hmm. So all of that is really promising, but it still feels to me like there's an infrastructure gap there that needs to be built in order for us to have a movement that has the ability to push people to action at critical moments and not just on a calendar, right? Yeah. So what are you seeing around that?
I mean, I actually see this thing building and in ways that are not necessarily what we anticipated. So when we did People's March in 2025. I'm like, I can't even remember what year it is. In 2025, when we did People's March, one of the things that we wanted to do that we sort of tried to build into that effort, into that coalition effort, was an absorption component, right? Where we said we need to get people into formation, into organizations that are existing. And so we built out, a tool that people could go to and say, oh, I'm interested in this issue area. Here's all these ways I can plug in. And we did find an infrastructure gap there, right? There weren't as many organizations who were prepared to take people en masse and to organize people en masse. The need didn't match what we had present, right? But what I do think we see, and especially if we think about this year, what we saw in Minnesota this year was that there is local infrastructure, and there are folks plugging in and building neighborhood by neighborhood. And so if we can give folks the tools, the training, the skills, the resources, then we don't necessarily have to have organizations that can take hundreds and thousands of people at a time. What we can have is smaller formations in communities that can then connect to organizations and be flanked by and resourced by organizations that are already existing. And so if we can build, if we can think of our work as building the infrastructure necessary to have a kind of at-scale distributed organizing model, then we can meet the need without having to build massive organizations that have huge footprints and can take and funnel in and have memberships of in the thousands, which I think there's a role for that too, right? But I also think that what it feels like to me is happening is that the things that we are putting down in certain terms of training, in terms of resources, people are picking up and people are building together collectively in their neighborhoods. Because I don't think that there was a way. I think that there are amazing organizations on the ground in Minneapolis, in Minnesota, who were ready to respond. And I think so much of that actually happened at the neighborhood level. And so what does it look like for us to offer skills building, to offer tools that people can use at the neighborhood and community level, that they don't actually need, you know, a staffed organization to like make happen, right? So how can we train people up on how to do people's assemblies so that they can practice democratic governance? How do we get people the kind of training and toolkits, like we see what the Freedom Trainers are doing and what 22CI folks are doing and what HOPE PV folks are doing in training folks up in how to do noncompliance and how to do, strategic nonviolence? How can we increase that? How can we build that mechanism so that we can get our folks the skills they need, and then we can support them and flank them without having to shape it and without having to have our hands on it. But we know that our folks are going and are moving, and then we help them connect to each other. That's what feels like is part of the infrastructure thing, is like, how can we, rather than being a starfish, how can we actually just be a web?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you know, we've been developing kind of a metaphor as a framework that we need many springs that feed one mighty river. So in other words, you know, recognizing that powerful movements are not built from a single source. They're the convergence of many streams, each drawing from its own leadership, ideological frameworks, and energy. Not an amalgamation of ideologies where everybody agrees on some sort of lowest common denominator, but where people are able to actually practice pluralism in action by being who they are and organizing with people like themselves, and then being positioned to be able to, at critical points, feed a river of change too powerful to be governed by authoritarians. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what are some of the springs that you're drawing from, and how do you stay ready to move when the river, with the river, when it's time?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I have my political grounding in prison industrial complex abolition. It is, you know, what shaped me and what grew me as a teenager. And, you know, I think I stay connected to that spring. And I stay fed by that. And I think, you know, the gender justice and sort of feminist, you know, landscape that feeds me and I stay connected and fed and shaped by that. I think both of those things actually speak to the point of what it is that keeps me prepared to flow with the river. I used to say in 2020, when COVID was happening, we're building with all of these people and we have to take action. And, you know, there's a need and a gap that we have to fill. And, you know, someone said to me, oh, you don't think that we share politics? How can you organize with me if we don't share politics? And I'm like, baby, I started as an abolitionist when nobody was calling themselves abolitionists. And so I had to, I never into a room presuming that people share politics with me, no matter what space it is. I am like, how can we get to the thing, to the vision? And we don't have to have the same terminology. We don't have to have the same, you know, starting point. As long as we have the same vision, then we can move. And so I think that, and also I think the way in which healing justice has shaped me as well. And Kara Page, who is my dear heart, who coined the term healing justice, one thing she always talked about is, she said, healing justice is a framework. It is not a movement. And she's like, there are frameworks that shape these things, and we can use those frameworks, but we can't see it as the movement itself, because the movement, you know, we can see it as a lens. And so I think about so many of the things that, you know, people hold very dear as like the way in which the politic that I have, I'm like, that's a lens for us to see the movement. And we can share our lens, but it is not the movement. It is not the river. Your lens is not the river. And so bring your lens to how you see it, how you see the movement, how you build a strategy around it. But there are other lenses, and we can bring all of our lenses. If we can, going back to the Cumbahee River collective piece around identity politics, if we can bring all of our lenses into the room, and all of our politics and all of our spring, it can help us to actually build a strategy that meets the most need, and a strategy that takes us the closest to the vision that we're heading to. And so that's how I sort of think about and approach it. I am never, you know, I know even at Women's March, as much as I love the team, I am very clear that we don't all have all the exact same politics, but I know that we do have a shared vision of the world. And so that is what, you know, keeps me ready to dive into the river.
All right. Well, now you see what we have Tamika on, right? I mean, that was a really beautiful articulation. You know, the characteristics of movements that win is that include that they're women-centered, right? But that they're also ideologically diverse. Mm-hmm. And the more ideologically diverse they are, the more likely they are to succeed. And so that, I think, is a beautiful way of understanding how we bring people together without trying to simply meld them into one kind of inoffensive set of ideas.
Right. Right. All the right words, but none of the ideas.
So this is a tough question. How do we turn mass action into power for renewing and reconstructing democracy?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's a big part of where Women's March is going this year. I had the great pleasure of spending several years working both at and alongside Project South as they were building sort of the U.S. social forum processes, the People's Movement Assembly processes. And so now we're about to have this partnership with Project South to sort of build out this process over the next year towards building a feminist agenda for a free America. And in doing that, what we're inviting folks into is all these folks who have taken action with us over the last, you know, Women's March is about to be 10 years old. So over the last 9 years, through hosting actions, volunteering as marshals, all those things, how do we actually bring them together and scale them up in how to move from mass action to assemblies, and in that, how to practice democratic governance. So then now you can actually be power building, either doing governance in your community or doing co-governance with your elected officials. Or sometimes that might look like actually we're running folks for office. That might look like, oh, we need to stop this thing that's happening. So we're actually going to be doing direct action or mass protest. But how do we decide those things together? And how do we build power together? How do we build community, the kind of community that reshapes how we work together and has the potential to reshape our understanding of democracy, our understanding of power, and how we engage and relate to it. And so we want folks to be coming together and doing assemblies that also land in, okay, we understand the landscape now. We know what we're fighting against. And now we have a vision. We know what we're fighting for. And then from there, we have a strategy of like, this is actually how we're going to do it. And so that's what we're trying to be up to, is over the next year, really being inside of the distributed model, trying to move assemblies, experimenting with what it might look like to do people's assemblies at scale. How can we have hundreds of people's movement assemblies across the country that then actually feed into each other, and we can synthesize and connect into one larger sort of assembly process that then sort of we are going feeding back and forth to each other from the collective to the local, from the national to the local, and back and forth. And so that's sort of what we're up to and what we're hoping to do is really say, hey, you took action. You've been hosting marches for the past 5 years. That's amazing. Let's build your skill a little bit more. And what we also know is if you look back at folks who studied that first march, that people moved into mass action there in the very first march in January 2007, or 2017, Lord, what is time? It's 2017. And then from there went and ran for office, or started organizations, or, you know, and did so many things that move from that action to that power. And so what we have to be doing is giving people the options and giving people the skills so that they can then take that entry step, which is showing up at an action, which is making a sign and marching, right? That very first step into the on-ramp, and give them all the other opportunities once they get there. And I think that's a place where sometimes we fall short, where we bring people all together. We bring people to the streets, or it might not necessarily be a place where we fall short. Sometimes we can't predict some of these mass mobilizing moments, right? Where people are in the streets. What we have to do is be prepared with all of the offerings on ways that they can continue to stay in the movement beyond that mass mobilizing moment.
Well, you mentioned People's Movement Assemblies in that answer. Can you give us a sense of what they are and where they fit?
Yeah, so People's Movement Assemblies come out of sort of the citizens' assemblies and people's assemblies we see in the Global South that were a part of a way for folks in communities to practice governance. And so what they do is how we talk about it is that there's a before, a during, and an after. So the before is you organizing your folks, bringing folks together, saying who needs to be in the room? How do we get all these folks in the room? And then you spend this concentrated period of time talking about, one, how do we build a collective understanding of what it is we're facing? From whatever your life lived experience is, wherever your frame and lens is, how do we bring that into the room so that we have a shared understanding of what is happening around us? And then how do we build a shared vision? And then inside of that concentrated time, that assembly, how do we build a shared strategy? What's next? And I think it differs from a conference or a meeting in that you're always trying to land at that what's next. You're always trying to land in very specific tasks, like not just like a, you know, one day we want to build a thing. No, what is your task when you leave the room? What are you going to do when you walk away? And then that's the during, and then the after is actually following up with each other to make that happen. And it's a cycle because you continue to have assemblies. There's not just a single assembly and then you're done. The assembly is a process that's ongoing, that is us coming together to practice collective governance, to build a collective understanding. And so we've seen it play out in so many different places. I think one of my favorite examples of people's assembly processes is when we look at Jackson, Mississippi, and the Jackson Kush process that was anchored by the Malcolm X grassroots movement and other organizations that led to the election of the first Chokwe Lumumba as mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. But we've also seen, you know, in Katrina 20, that assembly process just happened in August of last year, where you had folks come together to have a collective consciousness around what New Orleans, what the Gulf looks like 20 years after Katrina. What do we want the Gulf to look like, and what are we building, and how are we going to get there? And so there's just these beautiful processes of people coming together, different vantage points, different experiences, and getting in a room together to build the kind of connection and community that lasts and that cultivates change.
All right. Well, you said what's next. And so I want to go there for a minute. What should people be doing right now?
One of the things that anybody who's ever been on a Women's March call has heard me say a million times is get in where you fit in. Take some step, some action. And that's why I love, you know, marches. I think they're important because they are a single step that someone can take. Right. And so I think, you know, that people should talk to the folks in their networks, that are already in your existing networks. Talk to your aunties, talk to your church members, talk to your classmates, be in conversation about what is happening in ways that actually help people come to an understanding with each other, right? We're not having conversations off the rip, wherein we're saying you're wrong. That's not helpful. It's not helpful, friends. What we do want to do is try to find common ground with our folks. And you know, I think, you know, organizing 101 is to meet the people where they are, right? So you want to try to figure out where people are and meet them there and see how you can find a common ground that helps move them. And so I think that's important. I was in a barbershop and they're talking about Iran. And I'm like, oh, let's get into it. Let's have a conversation. And so wherever we are, we can be in dialogue. I think that's like a really important one that's easy. You can do it on your social media where you're sort of on your Facebook and grandma posts something and you know that is misinformation and you're not, you know, shaming, but how do you make an intervention there, right? And so I think that's really important. One of the things that we really try to skill people up in is how do you make those interventions in your own networks, right? That's one easy step. Sometimes it's not as easy, right? Talking to your loved ones is not always easy, but it is, you know, it is one of the sort of most simple steps. I also very much believe Stokely Carmichael talked about being an organization and the importance of being an organization. I deeply believe in being in and connected to organizations. Find an organization near you that does the work around an issue that matters to you, whatever that might be. And you bring your skill to that. If that is you make the meal for the meeting, if that is, you know, you're a great artist. When I organized domestic workers, we had one of our members who was phenomenal at decor. She was an artist. And whenever we would have an event, she would come in early and do our setup and just make it beautiful so that people felt welcome and they felt like they wanted to be in the room. So whatever it is, bring your talents and your gifts, whatever that might be. And you might not be a public speaker, and that is totally okay. You know, you might not be a facilitation is not everybody's bag. You might not be a facilitator. That's okay. But whatever it is, you got to the movement, we need it. And so, you know, you might be a childcare provider. We have a ton of colleagues who I love, dear ones from the domestic worker organizing that I did, who a part of their contribution to the broader movement is offering childcare. In other meeting spaces and for conferences, et cetera. So whatever it is, know that it is needed and it is necessary.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. You've all been listening to Tamika Milton of the Women's March. Thank you so much for being here, Tamika.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I know your time is precious, and so we really do appreciate it and feel honored that you would join us. What Tamika is describing is a kind of movement that doesn't burn out after one big march because it's built on relationships, trust, and the long work of knowing each other deeply enough to act together when it counts. That kind of movement gets built locally, in your community, among people who show up together over time. If you're not yet plugged into that kind of organizing in your area, now is the time to find it. And if you want to go deeper on the strategic framework behind what you heard today, the research on what actually defeats authoritarianism and how we get there from here, come read the Anti-Authoritarian Playbook on Substack at bit.ly/anti-authoritarian playbook. We're building this analysis in public together, and we'd love to have you in that conversation. Thanks for listening to the Anti-Authoritarian Podcast. If this conversation was useful to you, share it with someone who needs to hear it. That's how this movement grows. And get connected to the organizing happening in your community. The river doesn't form from one source. It starts where you are. We'll see you next time.